The parable trap. The parable trap. You know, with all the divisiveness and stuff in the news, I've started to realize why cable morning shows always air these, like, fluff pieces, you know? When you're listening to the news, it's like, you know, why am I hearing who got voted off, like, the Bachelorette or, you know, who didn't make the cut for Dancing with the Stars? Like, is that really, like, newsworthy stuff? I don't know. It seems like that's, you know, it kind of keeps things light, though. And when I was watching the news the other morning, they ran this piece about Dennis Quaid. Do you remember Dennis Quaid, the actor? Yeah, he's still around. Apparently, he got engaged recently. It's good for him, I suppose. And one of his old co-stars, this Natasha Richardson, she played a part with him on this movie, The Parent Trap. She kind of dug into him on social media, on Twitter. She said, watch out for those twins, you know, because they're twins in The Parent Trap, because apparently the woman that he's engaged to is so much younger than him, you know. So, you know, whatever. But The Parent Trap, I've been thinking about that movie this week as I've been reading the gospel lesson this morning. And the reason for that is because there is a trap, in a sense, that's sort of set. If you don't remember the movie, I'll tell you a little bit about it. The most recent one was from 1998, and the reason why I say the most recent one is because it's apparently a remake. It's apparently a remake where Quaid's character plays a guy named Nick, and Richardson's character, she plays a gal named Elizabeth. They live on opposite sides of the Atlantic. Each of them have one daughter, and the daughters, Hallie and Annie, are both played by Lindsay Lohan before she had all this like legal trouble, you know, and grew up, you know. And they are identical twins who are separated at birth. The two girls, they somehow connect. They engineer this identity swap with one another where essentially they switch parents for a time so they can spend time with the parent that they missed and eventually, you know, get the parents back together, you know, heartwarming. This crafty little scheme was meant to trap the parents to get them so they would somehow become a family together again. You know, it's very cute when you think about it. Not very realistic, but, you know, it's cute. And I'll leave that up to you to try to figure out, you know, what you're going to do with that. But the parable trap, I think, is kind of what Jesus gives us today in this short little but very complicated story that he leaves before us. He sort of sets a trap for his audience back then and a trap for us today. At the same time, I think this trap that he lays down teaches us about God's extravagant mercy and about not being superior or feeling superior to one another. And it's one that can expose our brokenness as people of faith in the process. So I want to share a little bit about Jesus' parable trap, not parent trap, with you this morning. And I'll let you determine what you might do with it this week. Because we're all grown-ups, and I think that we can chew on this difficult text together. So Luke 18, as Jill read, it begins by telling us that Jesus told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and regarded others with contempt. Now, I tried to share this with the kids, as squirming as my own children were. But here's basically what happens. In the story, it's almost like Jesus is a traveling pharmacist. That's the very first line. And he knows exactly what medicine to give to these people, his immediate audience. He knows these certain people need to hear a certain word. And perhaps that story has to do with what does it mean to be righteous? Being righteous means to be aligned with God, to be a real Eagle Scout for God, so to speak. To be righteous, to be in right relationship with God. So Jesus tells a story about being righteous to these people who, it seems like, have contempt for others. He knows what kind of medicine it is that they need. And here's how he starts off, in my own paraphrase. He says, once upon a time, two men went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee, and the other was a tax collector. And it almost sounds like a bad bar joke or something like that, you know. Jesus is kind of playing with caricatures in this story in order to lay the parable trap. So let's flesh things out a little bit here for you. I know in the past I have oversimplified, and maybe you've heard this in growing up or just in your experience of reading or Christian literature or whatever, but it's easy to oversimplify when you hear the word Pharisee. What comes to mind? What comes to mind? You can just shout it out. What do you think of when you hear the word Pharisee? What's an adjective that comes to mind? Oh boy. Well, I better lay down some for you. Oftentimes we hear of them and we think about people that are legalistic. You know, they adhere to the law. There are these religious, highfalutin people in the scripture, right? In fact, in many cases, they seem like they're the enemies of Jesus. They're set up that way. Well, the Pharisees in Jesus' day, they did place a lot of emphasis on the law and legal tradition, but they weren't legalists in the sense that we're trying to earn God's favor through legal observation. That's not exactly accurate to think of it that way. Thinking of them that way kind of robs them of their humanness and sets them up as kind of a straw man and sets Jewish people up as a boogeyman for Christians. And that's not fair. It's not fair. This story, among others, kind of feeds into those tropes that have been really unhealthy for Christian-Jewish dialogue today. One of my professors back at Luther Seminary, Matt Skinner, he writes this. He says, "This parable deals in characters and activities that are wildly misunderstood and have nourished anti-Jewish tropes in Christian communities." Not good. The thing is, living in accordance with Torah, with the law, in that Torah teaching, it really was a positive thing. It was a positive thing. It was a way of making God's benefits visible and accessible in all aspects of life for those that were Jewish. You know, every time we have a baptism here, I say, this is a way of seeing and us beholding together a visible sign of the invisible, of God's mercy in this tangible act of baptizing a baby or an adult or whoever. So in doing this stuff, in the legal observation of things, in the rituals, that's what the Jewish folks in his time, the Pharisees, that's really what they were doing. They were bringing it home, bringing God home into the mundane, into the everyday life stuff. This hit home for me when I was studying abroad in Germany a couple of years ago. More than a couple of years ago now, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, something like that. There was a Jewish woman named Aviva who was in the dorm right across from me. She attended Yale Divinity School, and I told her, hey, I was going to be a seminary student. One day after class, she took me to this creek outside of the dorm building, and she had this backpack with her full of silverware from the cafeteria. It had pots and pans and all kinds of things like that. These were items that she was going to use to cook. In her tradition, she had to purify them with a ritual before using them. And I explicitly remember her telling me she wanted to teach me this and why they do what they do as Jews. You know, would it make the ramen noodles taste different or the Easy Mac taste different? Probably not. But doing this faithful ritual, it brought God into the mundane rather than keeping God as some abstract idea somewhere off in the clouds. Ritual is a way of encountering God in all aspects of life, and this is what the Pharisees did in their observation of the law. So when we think of them as legalistic folks that are just so into the nitty-gritty that they forget about God, that's not fair. And the thing is, the Pharisees had a lot of priorities that aligned with Jesus. Some of them were very sympathetic to his movement. They wanted to be set apart as a holy nation, and in observing the rituals and the things that they did as Jews, it allowed them to do that. The Pharisees' emphasis on interpreting the law and their development of practical guidelines for legal observance, that explains why Jesus is always interacting with them. He's a rabbi, for crying out loud. The similarities he had with them led to dialogue. Sometimes they collided in their dialogues. But the thing is this. When we hear of these two men, one of whom was a Pharisee who went up to the temple to pray, it has to be noted that this was someone who wasn't an enemy. This was someone who wasn't the bad guy. This is someone who is like the picture-perfect way of seeing a religious person back in Jesus' day. But in this story, for us as Christians, when we hear it, he kind of functions as a walking, talking embodiment of arrogance and contempt for his neighbor. And that would not have been true of all Pharisees, maybe of some, but in this story, that's what we got. Now, we hear about a second guy that goes up to the temple to pray. It's not tax time yet, but, you know, I've got a picture of it up there. The second person is a tax collector. Now, in addition to oversimplifying and glossing over Pharisees, I know I've been guilty of this, as I've talked about tax collectors. Painted them with a broad brushstroke during my short tenure here. You know, what do you think of when you think of a tax collector? Maybe you think of H&R Block, you know. Maybe you think of, you know, the government sticking it to you or something like that. Well, tax collectors back in Jesus' day were not thought of very highly. People didn't trust them. Their work was kind of scandalous, especially as Jewish persons who were living in Roman-occupied Galilee. Rome had a system of taxing people that offended people. It really did. The tax-gathering system was thought of as corrupt, truly. My professor, again, Matt Skinner, wrote, "To collect taxes in places like neighborhoods, highways, markets, docks, Roman officials enlisted members of the population to bid for contracts. Tax collectors could line their own pockets with whatever they could collect over and above their contractual obligations." Not good. Sounds accurate? Throughout the Gospels, tax collectors were thought of as dishonest, as greedy, for reasons that are obvious from what I just read. But above all, they were thought as opportunists and collaborators who were willing to victimize their own neighbors while assisting the occupying force. They were seen as having betrayed their own people in order to help the enemy. And they were seen as having traded their religious, their social, their soul for financial gain. So back to the story. When we hear that these two men, one of whom was a Pharisee, went up to the temple to pray, and one a tax collector, Jesus has set a trap, because there's a lot behind these two guys, the Pharisee and the tax collector. We've made up in our minds, perhaps, when we hear this story about who is the winner, who's the one that, you know, got right with God. You know, because whether you were a crowd listening in Jesus' day, hearing him tell the story, or whether you're hearing it today, how couldn't you, if you had these caricatures in your mind, think about who is the clear winner in this story? You know, who is the one that goes back justified and made right with God? The Pharisee, we hear, basically prays from somewhere in the front row of the pews of the temple, "Dear God, thank you that I'm not like everybody else, all those dirty sinners. You know, I fast twice a week. Oh, in case the people in the back didn't hear, I give a tenth of my income. Look at me." You know, it's a caricature. "I'm your faithful servant, God." And the tax collector, we hear, doesn't even come up to the front of the temple. He's somewhere far off in the nosebleed section, perhaps. Maybe he's up in the balcony or something like that. He knows he's a sinner, and of the two of them, he's clearly not the picture, the perfect picture of Jewish faith. You know, he's the sellout. You know, he's the obvious sinner in this story, right? I met with a group of colleagues earlier this week, and my breath was taken away when he shared a reading that was written by a Jewish woman who fleshes through the parables in the New Testament. Because she had done some translation work that is very easy to lose. The New Testament's written in Greek, and, you know, when we read it here, we're reading it in English. And there's a very easy word to lose track of. In that phrase, the very last phrase where it says, "This man, the tax collector, went down justified rather than the other," we often miss a word. The word para in Greek, like parallel parking, you know, paralyzed, whatever, it means alongside of, together, side by side. Everywhere else in the New Testament, that is what that word means. But for whatever reason, the way that it's translated here, "This man, the tax collector, went down justified rather than the other," it's translated "rather than the other," instead of "side by side," "together." So instead of these two guys, the Pharisee and the tax collector, walking out, I don't know if they'd be arm in arm, you know, if they'd be walking down, talking together, leaving church at the same time, we hear that one of them went instead of the other. But the word, another translation of it is, both of them went together, side by side. And that changes the meaning of the story altogether. The way that we hear that the tax collector went rather than the other, the Pharisee, kind of pits the two men against one another. One is justified and made right with God, and the other is not. But that's not really the case. Not the case at all. But in a sense, we have had a trap laid for us. How different a reading might we have if we understood that both men were justified, not just the tax collector. That both sinners are subject to God's mercy. Now, there's a lot going on here. The differences between these two guys, how they stand, how they pray, what they pray for. By telling this parable to his audience then and to us today, Jesus has laid a parable trap. Whenever we want to write off or be critical of one of the characters or distinguish our values from them, the parable exposes the disdain that we have or the caricatures that we've built up for Pharisees and tax collectors in our mind. But the thing is, there are no clean players in this story. And when we glom on to one of them as the perfect picture of faith, or when we say that one is justified and one is not, when we point to the faults of one and hold up the other, the trap snaps shut on us and gets tighter and tighter. Again, I quote my colleague Matt Skinner, who said, "Disdain is the manifestation of a belief that we know better than God who should receive mercy and how they should receive it." End quote. This parable trap might snap shut on us when we believe that there are people that are beyond the scope of God's mercy. That trap is an easy one to fall into when we get roiled by the news, or when we hear about someone or something that seems evil, or when we've been wronged by another and we feel disdain deep in our hearts. Church, this simple story has got a lot of layers. Jesus shared it with an original audience in his day. Those that were around him were probably surprised. Their jaws probably dropped when they heard that the tax collector went away justified. And that the Pharisee, the respectable peer that they had, didn't go away with more advantages with God than the obvious sinner. But this parable trap tells us that we can't be so arrogant, so judgmental in others, that we believe that one of us knows better or has more access to God than an undeserving other. All kinds of people are capable of being contrite in their hearts or of contempt in their hearts. My prayer that I'll leave you with today is that hearing this parable and hearing about this parable trap, that we can be slower to characterize and caricaturize our neighbors, those that are different from us, for one, and that we can listen to the parable's more powerful message, that God's extravagantly merciful way is beyond our wildest imagination and dreams. What shall we pray to an extravagantly merciful God? Of this God who sends away religious persons and tax collectors justified together, how shall we live, having learned about God's boundless mercy?